The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
In the Buddhist teachings, there's a phrase that has caught my attention over the years. It's practicing in accordance with the Dharma. Practicing in accordance with the Dharma. It's used quite a bit by the Buddha in the teachings, actually. It's not just a kind of a one-time thing that he says in one little place. He uses it fairly frequently in something that he brings out in his talks. One way that the Buddha talked about it is that practicing in accordance with the Dharma is one of the key factors that supports us to wake up. So it's a kind of a key one. And a bit more poetically, the Buddha said that people who practice in accordance with the Dharma beautify the Sangha. How about that? They beautify the Sangha. So today I wanted to explore this a bit, this phrase. The Pali for it is Dhamma nu Dhamma Patipanno, practicing in accordance with the Dharma. So I think there are several different dimensions to what this can mean. And some of that variation has to do with the range of meaning of the word Dharma itself, which is a vast term that can cover a lot of territory. You know, the word itself covers different domains. And in addition, there's said to be about a half dozen qualities of the Dharma, which is not the focus, but they'll sort of come in as we're talking about it. So the Dharma can be the teachings of the Buddha. You know, this is a Dharma talk, and we're focusing on the Buddha's teachings. And so here, maybe being in accordance could mean something like following the instructions. So we're not just getting information in a Dharma talk from a teacher. That might be part of it. There are explanations, there are descriptions, but there are also instructions, among other things, things that we can do or perspectives that we can take that will help us move toward freedom from suffering. You know, you may have gotten instructions at some point on mindfulness of breathing or on mindfulness of emotions or mind states. I don't know, mindfulness of aversion, for example. So maybe you were told to feel the aversion in the body, or to name it. You know, name, recognize that aversion has come into the mind and name it in order to create a little gap before we, you know, we just act on the aversion. So these are examples of, you know, instructions that we get for how to live with our body and mind and world in a way that's relatively free. You know, and if we're doing those instructions when a strong emotion like aversion comes up, then we could say that we're practicing in accordance with the Dharma, within what the Buddha taught. I wanted to offer this story that's found in Gill's book, A Monastery Within. Identical twin sisters found their way to the monastery. At first, it was very difficult to distinguish one from the other, and the monks and nuns often confused them. Not only did they look the same, but they also had the same mannerisms, identical ways of talking, and as nuns, they wore the same robes. In addition, they both had extremely aversive personalities. They were astute observers who seemed always to see what was wrong. But after some months, marked differences began to appear between them. They remained as aversive as ever. However, one sister became more and more dour and discouraged. The other became increasingly happy. Soon enough, the first sister left the monastic life, though this did nothing to improve her dark state. The second sister went on to become the guest master, and many of the monastery guests remarked how her happiness was contagious. The first sister directed her aversion outwardly. When she suffered, all she could see was what was wrong with the world. The second sister looked inward when she suffered. She focused on being averse to her aversion and toward whatever clinging created it. The first sister was crushed by her aversion. The second was liberated by hers. So we get these instructions, and it's consequential whether we follow them or not. So it's interesting to observe in ourselves, you know, whether that we maybe don't always follow the instructions, do we? I mean, sometimes we just forget, of course, or, you know, it happens too quickly and we didn't have a chance. But there are other things, you know, we can start to see with a mindfulness practice that things get in the way of our actually doing these instructions. It's normal that there's some challenge for us, because not all of us is on board with this process of waking up, right? Our doubt is not on board. Our ignorance is not on board. So when we run into those things, they can sometimes get in the way. Maybe there's fear. Maybe there's ego. I want to do it my way. Why should I listen to the teacher? The mind is very tricky. You know, when it's putting up doubt or resistance, we literally might not hear the instructions accurately. Some people worry a lot about whether they're doing it right in practice. So I want to address that directly. I want to name that, at least, is that this phrase, in accordance with the Dharma, I hope that the word accordance maybe feels a little bit more accommodating than the idea of doing it right. There's a little aversion in whether I'm doing it right or not. So maybe we could ask something like, are we in harmony with what the Buddha offered? So if you're someone who is frequently concerned about whether or not you're doing it right, maybe you could ask instead, am I in harmony with what I understand of the teachings? That might soften it a little bit. So thinking about these two sisters, you know, who were both aversive, but one learned how to work within that and find freedom, and the other did not. Maybe one criterion for knowing if our practice is in accordance is, are unwholesome states decreasing and wholesome states increasing, or the reverse? You know, are we actually becoming happier or freer in some way? And we don't have to check moment to moment to moment, because there are times where we have a period of some dukkha or some dryness in the practice. But in a long-term sequence, are we generally decreasing our unwholesome states and increasing the wholesome ones? And remember that mindfulness is wholesome, so that helps. But of course, there's more to the teachings of the Buddha than just meditation instructions. So we should look beyond that also. You know, more broadly, being in accordance with the teachings maybe would be being on the path. Are we doing the steps of the Eightfold Path in our life? So if we're, for example, if we're only doing meditation, that's our thing, we meditate, but we're not paying any attention to ethics or wisdom in our life, it might be hard to get fully in tune. That would be like tuning one string of our guitar to a tuning fork. Got that one string in tune, but we didn't check any of the other strings. You know, how is that going to be when we try to play the guitar? So when we're bringing all the qualities of the path into accord together, then we could say that the path is unfolding. You know, sometimes we're working more on one than another, and there can be periods of, of focus. But generally, we would want to be working on all of the aspects of our life broadly together so that they can all harmonize and unfold together. One of the qualities of the Dharma, I said I would sometimes bring in the classical qualities of the Dharma. One of them is that it is onward leading, opanayiko. So it means that we don't get stuck. forever. We can't be stuck forever if we're in accord with the Dharma. Maybe I should name the steps of the path, just in case someone is not familiar. I use this word right, but it's not really right. It's, let's say, appropriate or complete or wise. So, appropriate view, appropriate intention, appropriate speech, appropriate action, appropriate livelihood, appropriate effort, appropriate mindfulness, and appropriate concentration. So all of those factors, you can see that they encompass our view of the world, how we see things, how we see ourselves, how we act, speech, action, livelihood, and also how we train our mind through making some effort, through mindfulness, through collectedness of mind. So there's another teaching where the Buddha talks about how a person understands the path when they are practicing in accordance with the Dharma. How do they frame it in their mind if they're practicing in accordance? And in general, what this teaching says is that people like that understand two things overall. First of all, they understand that thoughts of greed, hatred, and delusion, those are the main problems in the mind. So thoughts of greed, hatred, and delusion are ended by practicing well. That's how they're ended. They're ended by doing practice, and not because of things like material gains or other material circumstances. So the result of this is that they're very careful about not extolling themselves and disparaging others. You know, let's say you practice for a while and, I don't know, you become a teacher, you become a mindfulness teacher. But you don't say, oh, this makes me so great, you know. Instead, there's an understanding, no, what is helping my mind to purify or improve or get more in alignment is because I'm practicing. And so one focuses on just continuing the practice. And then second, which is kind of a more specialized part of the first, is that even when a person experiences what are considered attainments or important things on the path, like, I don't know, cultivating deep concentration or going on a long retreat or having an insight of some kind, even then they understand that identifying with those things is not part of the path. So once again, it's always just continuing to focus on the practice is the sign of being in accordance with the Dharma. So this is how we think about our path, think about our practice, if we're practicing in accordance with the Dharma. We're not measuring our success or comparing ourselves with others. So another meaning of Dharma, it's related to the teachings of the Buddha, but another meaning of Dharma is simply nature, or how things work. You know, how do things work? So as we practice with our own particular experience, who else's experience are going to practice with? So we sit down, we feel our body and its various aches and pains and challenges. We have our mind and we have our memories that come up and the emotions and what it is that we're trying to figure out in our life right now. All of those things are part of our, you know, what we can be mindful of in our experience. That's what we do. And yet, as we watch just these specific things about us, we start to see patterns, and we start to eventually see into more universal characteristics, as we would say. So we watch our own mind, but we're learning about how the mind works for everyone. You know, everyone has dukkha, and everyone has clinging, unless we're totally free. So we start to see these more foundational or fundamental things that are going on, and our particular experience are just examples of those. So we come to have our own experience with foundational Dharma principles like the Four Noble Truths or like dependent co-arising, things occur because of conditions. We start to actually see that in our experience or just generally, you know, how it is for humans. And a big aspect of that is seeing impermanence. For example, that's one thing that we often emphasize here is noticing that things change and they come and they go. Arise and pass. It's very hard to find something that's been constant for our whole life. So there's a famous phrase that people say when they have deep insight into impermanence. All that is of the nature to arise is of the nature to pass away. This is kind of an insight that we can have. And I name it because in that phrase, nature, all that's of a nature to arise, the word is dharma. Everything that is of the dharma to arise is of the dharma to pass away. That's how it is. So then we start to get into, you know, when we start to see how these teachings of the Buddha are actually applying in our own experience, they're true for us, we start to have maybe what a kind of a felt sense of the Dharma, a felt sense of accordance. Does this make sense? Like kind of a feeling of alignment or attunement in the body. And this relates to some of the other qualities of the Dharma. It's said to be visible here and now, sanditiko. So the Dharma is something that we can see right here. You know, I walked into the room and I was in a lousy mood and I noticed the tear in the carpet. There isn't a tear in the carpet here, but, you know, suppose that. And then we see in our mind, oh, when I'm in a bad mood, I tend to see what's wrong with a place. We see it operating right there in our mind. Whereas, you know, if I'd been feeling happy about the spring flowers I just saw, maybe what I notice is the happy faces of the people coming in. So we start to see how the conditions are flowing along. They're changing, they're impacting my experience. The Dharma is also said to be timeless, akaliko, or immediate, another translation, in the way that natural laws, you know, always work. They're kind of there all the time in the background. So we start to see that aspect of the Dharma. The word accord is related to words like concord or discord. It's something like being in tune, musically, consonant. We could also say not dissonant. So there's a way that this is really true viscerally. Sometimes we touch into it first in meditation. You know, we're sitting and, yeah, there's challenging things happening in the mind, but we start to kind of orient ourselves toward, oh, could I align with this somehow? Could my body be physically aligned? Could my mind be aligned? So we start to feel into the Dharma, and that takes us deeper than just knowing it cognitively or thinking about it. If we really understand that things are impermanent, we'll have a different relationship to things in our life. It doesn't make so much sense to cling when we see how all of experience is changing. So to be in accordance with the Dharma, when we see into these foundational principles, helps us get lighter and lighter in our life. Nonetheless, it's still possible to be a little bit off. So I want to name ways that we can also, you know, feel a bit if we're getting out of accordance. Number one is that we can get conceptual. You know, we think about whether or not there's a rule or a principle, something I heard in a talk that I should be applying right now. And often it's skillful to start with that. You know, for example, we learn the five precepts as the kind of ethical basis for life as a layperson. And so we might think about those and consider whether or not we're applying that principle correctly. But eventually, connecting with the Dharma is not meant to be so conceptual. It's not meant to be something that we think about quite so consciously. Just as an example, if we are applying the precepts really as rules that we may have learned and are trying to apply, we will eventually start to run into a lot of uncertainty. We can start to run into uncertainty. You know, for example, we might know that one of the precepts says that we should not lie. We should not, we should not say what knowingly what we know is to be false. Clear enough, it's a rule. So then what about a trivial lie in order to make someone feel happy or comfortable? If we have a rule of always stating the exact factual truth, but we also have a value of caring for our friends, what about that moment, that classic moment when they say, do you like my sweater? And you don't. You know, it can be a real moment of uncertainty for if we have a rule system in conflict with our care for this person. So practice in accordance cannot only mean following conceptual principles. It's more flexible than that. It's not so rigid. If you're wondering what the answer is, there isn't. There isn't one clear answer for how to move through that moment. But if we are attuned in accordance with the Dharma, we can find something to say somehow that navigates that. Another way that we can get a little bit off is actually, the felt sense, which I pointed to second, it's closer, it's more flexible, but even the felt sense can be a little bit off. And that can happen when we get focused on one particular feeling. So again, an example. Suppose we have an experience where we're feeling tightness in our chest. You've gotten attuned to the body, you're going through the world with mindfulness, and you feel that you've gotten a little bit tight in the heart area. And as you're mindful of that, the tightness melts away and you feel your heart open. It's a beautiful experience when something like that happens. We come into attunement and somehow we open. But then the mind can fix onto that and say, oh, that exact feeling is what it means to be in accordance with the Dharma. That's the feeling of it. It's when my heart melts and feels open. So then, after that, we go through the world. We are continually monitoring the feeling in our chest for tightness. And if there's any tightness, we try to make it relax. Right? So I'm hamming it up a little bit, but I've done patterns like this, where I had a certain experience and I felt like, oh, that's it. That's it. Now I've got it. And so then there can be a subtle trying to make that happen again, or believing that that's what the Dharma feels like. So it kind of makes sense, but freedom or Dharma is not any one particular feeling. It's not any one particular kind of felt sense. It's not always the same way. And we don't want to get into manufacturing feelings. So we have to be a little bit careful. So we can get off by bringing in too many theories and too many ideas, or by getting attached to a certain kind of feeling or a certain kind of emotion. So maybe a good image then, we're painting a bigger picture now. How do we consider this idea then of accordance with the Dharma? Maybe a good image is to see in terms of a process of attunement, kind of a dynamic balance, like the way riding a bicycle is a dynamic balance. If you're riding a bike, you're almost always falling over in some direction, but you're always pulling yourself back toward being in alignment, always moving toward balance. So we have a gradual practice. We're finding our way toward more and more accordance with the Dharma. But we don't always get it right. We definitely don't always get it right. And even if we do get it right for a little while, then the conditions change and things are off balance slightly. And so maybe we think more about moving toward balance instead of getting to balance and staying there. There's very little where we're just, set it and forget it in the Dharma. So I feel like as we discover what practicing in accordance with the Dharma means and what it means for us, it will take us toward the maturing of both our thought and our emotion. So when our thought maybe originally was very conceptual and a little bit rigid, we sort of move toward being more flexible in how we think and having more intuition, the sort of the mature form of the cognitive mind. And similarly, our emotional heart, I don't know that they're so separate, but let's pretend for a moment. Maybe we start out with a lot of reactivity and difficult experiences, and then over time that smooths out a little bit, and we move toward qualities like compassion or goodwill or, ways of understanding relationship that are part of some larger whole, kind of a maturing of the emotional side also. We might still be aversive, like that one of the sisters, have a critical mind that can see the challenges with things, but we move toward using that well, and we have more and more happiness, like she did. Or we might always have kind of a sensual orientation. Maybe you're that type, but that can move into metta, for example. You know, love, instead of love of sensual things, we move toward universal love that connects beings together. It looks different for different people. So this maturing process can take some turns also. Often we can reach a new level of accordance when we give up or surrender. Have any of you seen this in your practice? Things can't change and they're sort of stuck or dry. And we're putting in effort, and we do have to put in effort in order to engage. But at some point, what's most fruitful is to give up, to let go. Sometimes it's about us doing something in order to practice. If we don't do anything, I would guess that we will continue to keep suffering. If you just sit on your couch waiting to awaken, probably will end up just continuing to suffer. But there are also times when we're getting in our own way, in a sense, or our view, our way of seeing things is itself limiting. And we sort of grapple with that, and at some point it's the stepping back that helps for the Dharma to lead us onward. So then a question for us is, can we learn to trust in the unfolding of our own specific experience? You know, can we learn to trust the flow of the Dharma? And it might not look how we think, this accordance. I want to tell a story now of it's a true story of an Irish Trappist monk, so a Catholic monk, who his story of his experience was Zen meditation. So he was early in his monk life, he was given a book about Zen, and he wasn't very interested in it. Somebody gave it to him and said, "You might find this interesting," and he thought, "I don't think so." And the person further qualified the book by saying, "This is a Spanish translation of an English translation of the German original, and it's a bad translation." So he really wasn't very excited about reading this book, but he did agree to read it, and he did. And he got two things from this book. One was he got instructions for how to sit on a cushion. And, you know, which he had never done, right? And he decided to try it because he was often falling asleep when he was sitting in the pew in the church, or you know, wherever he was sitting in the church, he was often falling asleep. So he got a pile of blankets. He didn't have a meditation cushion. So he got a big pile of blankets and he sat on it. And he figured, if I'm sitting in a position like this with my legs crossed, I'm not going to fall asleep as easily. And then so the second thing he got out of the book was it had a koan in it. He didn't know the word koan. He didn't really know what that meant. But it had this question. And the question was, "What was your face before you were born?" Which is a classic koan from the Zen tradition. And so he had no idea what a koan was or how to work with it. He didn't have any instructions for sitting meditation. He didn't have a teacher. But for some reason, in his heart, he was drawn to engaging with this practice. And so he just did his best to follow the instructions. So his fellow Catholic monastics were teasing him gently about whether he was really Catholic or was he Buddhist. They also asked him to sit somewhere else because it was distracting for them when he sat on his pile of blankets in the church. So he found a little room to sit by himself. And he contemplated this koan about his face before he was born. And after a long time of doing that, making adjustments along the way that felt intuitively right, you know, he really did his best. And he tried. He did make some changes. But eventually he decided that he hadn't seen anything and there was really nothing coming from this practice. And so he was a little bit sorry that he hadn't ever really found a teacher to learn more about it. And he decided to give up. So he stood up, and in his words, "That's when I saw my face before I was born." Later, he met some Zen teachers, and he actually eventually became a Roshi, an authorized Zen teacher, in addition to still remaining a Trappist monk. And he said that all of this drew him much closer to the deepest teachings of Jesus. He really understood how those point toward emptiness. That was his understanding So this too, I would say, is practice in accordance with the Dharma, really bringing himself to it, really living the sincerity of his engagement with this. And maybe you'll agree with me that there's some beauty to this monk's path and how he just kept engaging. So how about us? So engaging, when we engage with Dharma practice, which all of us are in some way, even if this is the very first time you came here or the very first time you're tuning in on YouTube, you're here. So in some way, you're engaging with the Dharma right now. And so we often will find that we'll run into unfamiliar terms, like practicing in accordance with the Dharma. As I said, this has caught my attention over the years. I didn't know at all what it meant when I first read it, the very first time. And I found it to be fruitful to engage over the years and consider in my own practice, you know, what is this? How does it unfold? What does it mean for me now? How do we explore and familiarize ourselves with terms like this? If it feels important or relevant or interesting, I encourage you to engage with terms, even if they seem like they're, like you're not sure what they mean. So one, you know, we've been doing a little bit of that during this talk. I've been kind of exploring different dimensions, trying to create a larger picture. You're welcome to take the ones that make sense to you and leave the ones that don't. So we can also step back a little bit and kind of consider that process itself. You know, what is it that we're doing? So we might engage with a Dharma term by posing a question. That monk had a koan as a question. Some Buddhist traditions have made this into an art form. We don't do that so explicitly, but even less formally, questions are a very good way to engage with the Dharma. So we can pose the question, what does it mean to practice in accordance with the Dharma? But the question might be then, to whom or to what are we posing that question? Are we posing it to our intellect, our linguistic mind? I decided to pose this question to ChatGPT. So I thought it was interesting. I thought I would read you the answer. So I typed in, what does practice in accordance with the Dhamma mean? I think I'll read it in the voice that kind of goes with it. The term Dhamma typically refers to the teachings of the Buddha, which emphasize the development of ethical behavior, mindfulness, and wisdom. Therefore, practice in accordance with the Dhamma means to practice in accordance with the ethical principles, mindfulness, and wisdom taught by the Buddha. In practical terms, this means striving to cultivate wholesome thoughts, speech, and actions while avoiding unwholesome ones. It also means developing mindfulness or a clear and non-judgmental awareness of one's thoughts, feelings, and surroundings. Lastly, it means cultivating wisdom or an understanding of the nature of reality and the causes of suffering as taught in the Buddhist tradition. Overall, practicing in accordance with the Dhamma means making a conscious effort to live in a way that aligns with the teachings of the Buddha, with the goal of reducing suffering and cultivating inner peace and happiness. QED. So in terms of basic information content, I have to admit that this might be a lot of what I've said during this talk. I don't know, do you guys need Dharma teachers anymore? I would probably change a little bit of the language. I saw a few holes in the doctrine there. But, you know, it's good information, actually. It's pretty good information. But do you think it gets you all the way there? No. What about that Trappist monk who didn't have any of this information? He had no books. He had no teacher. He had no ChatGPT. But he did sit on a pile of blankets and sincerely apply his mind until his heart opened. So in exploring a Dharma term, we are not just posing a question to our language-oriented mind. You know, the answer to our question is not a bunch of information. It's not about the language. We're posing the question to our citta, to our heart-mind, or even more broadly, to our whole body-heart-mind system. That means that we can use the whole body-heart-mind system to resonate with that question. A friend of mine, I think, said it nicely. She said, accordance is multidimensional. Mind, heart, and body are all used to connect to wisdom and knowing in this moment, knowing right now, such that practice is in accord. Another of the qualities of the Dharma is that it is inviting us to come and see, ehi pasiko. In particular, note that the body is involved. You know, we can consider the Dharma or drop in a question and then feel the energetic ripples in our body. That's it. No need to cognize what's going on, create a story, figure it out. So to do this kind of full engagement with a Dharma term or question is kind of like living it, to live the question. I'm borrowing that phrase. There's another phrase that we could ask, you know, what is live the question? It's from actually comes from the Western tradition. It's from a work called Letters to a Young Poet by Rainer Maria Rilke. This is a fairly oft-quoted segment. Have patience with everything that remains unsolved in your heart. Try to love the questions themselves, like locked rooms and like books written in a foreign language. Do not now look for the answers. They cannot now be given to you because you could not live them. It is a question of experiencing everything. At present, you need to live the question, and perhaps you will gradually, without even noticing it, find yourself experiencing the answer. So to live the question of what it means to practice in accordance with the Dharma is to take that question into daily life, into relationship, into work, into community life, into deep into your heart while sitting on the cushion, all of those. It takes some trust and confidence to listen carefully to that question that you've posed with your whole mind, body, heart, and then actually go into it, to actually go with it, to actually change things in your life in order to live by that question. This is your life. It matters. It matters what you do. So maybe you have some sense now of what it means to say that somebody who is practicing in accordance with the Dharma beautifies the Sangha. The Buddha loved to see people engaging with the teachings and really seeing how they play out in their own life. And he created an environment where people could do that. They could give themselves fully to the teachings. So I've been here with the IMC community for a long time, and I can say that it's quite a good place for practicing in accordance with the Dharma. It's a place where people can try out different ways of being, where they can feel some harmony and yet enough security to be daring with how they are. And there's support all along the path for engaging with our ethics, our mental training, our wisdom. All of that is here. And I think we see that beauty among us today. And we can even extend it out into the folks on YouTube who are joining us. We can see how far across the world the beauty is spreading. So thank you all for your beauty and your engagement with the Dharma. There's a few more minutes. We can, if anybody would like to ask questions or comments. Yes, here. Why don't you wait for the microphone? Thank you.
This? I was just wondering what the Sangha is.
The Sangha, what is it? Wow, there's a whole other explanation that we could do. Yeah, I did use that term without defining it. Thank you. Probably other people want to know too. So Sangha is the Pali word for the community. Generally, it refers to the community. In the West, we use it as the community of practitioners. So like this is the IMC Sangha, the IMC community. More traditionally, it refers either to the monastic Sangha, people who are ordained, or actually the most generally, it refers to people who have some understanding of the Buddhist teachings, so people who have reached some deep insight into it and can serve as guides for others. And maybe one more dimension I'll mention is that the Sangha is one of the refuges for us. So Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are the places where we can orient toward in order to support our practice as we're going along the path. But does that help? Yeah. Thank you for asking the question. Here's another one.
Thank you. It's on. Could you share the name of the Trappist monk? Did he write anything?
Oh, it's a good question. I didn't write his name down. I found a video where he spoke about this in a Buddhist Christian conference, and I didn't catch his name, so I'm sorry for that. But it was a recent video, and he was right there speaking it, so I'm sure he is alive. Well, I'm not sure, but as of when he made the video. Anything else? One more, yeah.
You talked about the twin nuns and how they were both aversive, and then one was no longer as aversive or actually followed the Dharma. How do you handle or approach friendships and relationships in your life with people who are aversive or become more aversive over time? How do you work with that?
That's a good question. So is such a person a practitioner or not?
Most likely not.
Most likely not. Yeah, we can't always know for sure, huh? So then what we're working with is how it feels for us in relationship with that person. And it can be that we need to be in relationship with this person. We don't have a choice. Is that the case? I have the feeling you're referring to a specific example, but we don't need more details, but is that true? Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So then we do still have some choice, right? We have our own sense of what's coming up in us in response to observing or experiencing that aversion. Of course, if there's any danger, you know, if the aversion is directed toward you in a harmful way, then, you know, there would need to be some care taken for yourself. I just want to state that right up front. But if it's a little bit more of an observational thing, then there are things that we can cultivate to protect ourselves, essentially. So certainly mindfulness. You know, being aware, okay, I'm observing that. We are allowed to observe things externally, internally, and both. But in yourself, probably the first cultivation is equanimity, accepting the reality, okay, this is what's going on for that person. I don't know what's happening inside of them, but accepting it. And then there can be also some connection in that people who are behaving aversively and not apparently aware of it are probably suffering. So an appropriate response for you might also be compassion for them and for you, for the experience that you're having. So there are ways that we can begin to change ourselves in relationship to this energy, such that it is less harmful. It's not coming into us and getting stuck. You may need techniques also to allow energy to move through, or you may need to, you know, physically move to a different place when things are happening. You know, you can leave the room, or even, I'm giving a wide range, set a boundary, things like that. But generally, we have more options than we think we do. Is this helping?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Yeah, and of course, if you want to speak sometime with a teacher about more specifics of that, there might be also things that I could say more specifically than in a general setting. Yeah. Oh, looks like we're at the time. So thank you, everyone. It's been a delight.